Welcome to the East County Magazine live radio show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio representing the public interest, not special interest. Broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso on KNSJ 89.1 FM, your host, Miriam Raftery.
Now, straight from the headlines, we bring you the latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery, and I'm here today with Jerry Dean. Jerry handles the marketing and talent coordination at the San Diego Performance Academy in Santee, which is where our show is being taped. But she also has another side to her, and we really thought it was important to let the community know about what she's doing. Jerry is the founder of Missing Persons of America. They have a website, missingpersonsofamerica.com, and they help track down missing people nationwide. Welcome, Jerry. It's great to have you on the show. Now, tell us what your impetus was to get involved in this. What compelled you to start a site to find missing people?
Well, I found that subject of missing people was very, very interesting, and I couldn't get enough of it. Every time I read or heard about somebody that was missing, I had to do more research. I wanted to know why. Why were they missing?
And you had a personal experience with a missing person or people in your own family, I understand. Can you share that with us?
Back when, many years ago, my brothers, they were twins, and my sister were abducted by their father. And my mother could not find them. It was years and years. It took 10 years before she was able to locate them through a private investigator.
That must have been terrifying. How old were you at the time?
I was not born when they were abducted. And then I was born about 4 years later. And I grew up knowing that they were out there somewhere.
Wow.
But I didn't know much more than that. And it was just that they were out there somewhere. And so when I got the chance to meet them for the first time, I was about 9 years old. And it was quite different to see these kids who were teenagers at this point that were part of my family.
Wow. What was that reunion like? How well did it work out? Did you become close?
It was pretty shaky in the beginning because they had been told their whole life that their mother didn't want them. And it was very, very shaky.
Heartbreaking.
And over the process of time, they realized who my mother really was and who I was and who my father was. And they became part of the family. My mother never got full custody of them. She only had visitation rights.
Wow.
But we,
because in those days, the laws were very different.
Yeah, the laws were very different back then. Yeah, you do that, you could go away with your children and you wouldn't get in trouble for it. So, but luckily, it was only about 4 to 5 years before they became 18 years old and they were able to go and do wherever they wanted to at that point.
In a way, though, your family was fortunate that at least these kids, your brothers, were found safely. They didn't come to physical harm. For some other families, that's not the case. What compelled you after so many years to come forward about 2 years ago and start the missingpersonsofamerica.com site?
I realized that there was not any equality when it came to missing people. Some people got all the attention. Holly Bobo, for instance, over in Tennessee, when she disappeared, it was national news. Yeah. Then you take another person that was the same age, same look, everything, maybe over in Mississippi. They didn't even know that she existed. There was no real twist to the story. So if there's no twist, a lot of these missing people don't get any kind of media attention whatsoever.
Yeah, you mentioned the JonBenet Ramsey case as an example.
JonBenet Ramsey case, yes.
Of one that had so much media attention while
other children that are disappeared, no one knew about them.
How many people are missing every day in America?
It's about 2,300 people a day are missing, and it's constant. It's not the same people, but it changes. But it's kind of a consistent 2,300.
So tell us about your website.
The website has everything. Every time I hear about a case, I put it on there so that people can go there and they can share out the posters, they can share out the information, they can read information. I go into a lot of research in detail about a missing person. So you're going to find more there than you would on a regular media story. I also get a lot of tips that I share with people. And then also I get tips where it helps me do more research to what's going on with that. And then in turn, I can sometimes go back to the families with that tips and help them zero in where maybe that missing person went.
You've actually solved some cases.
Solved some cases, yeah.
Wow. You were telling me before the show a little bit about a missing teenager. Can you give us some details yes. for our listeners?
There was a mother that contacted me because her teenage girl was missing, and she was labeled as a runaway, and I went and did what as I usually do, and I let everybody know that she was missing, and I helped put up a missing person poster and circulated it around. As a result of that, I ended up with an anonymous tip, and it said pretty much, look here, and it directed me to a site, an underground site, and there she was.
Underground,
it was a pornographic site.
Wow, child porn.
Child porn, and I wasn't positive it was her. It looked very similar to her, but I needed her mother to verify. Oh. And it was a very upsetting thing to have to do, but I had to make sure. Mm-hmm. And when I gave the stuff over to the mother, she looked at it and said, yes, that was her daughter.
Oh,
and it took several days.
Thing.
And then we went to the police, and it took several days, but they did rescue her, and she was being held in a motel.
Wow. And did that also help law enforcement take down a child pornography ring?
Yes, it resulted in finding out that they were, it wasn't just her, there was other people that they were holding.
So what you're doing is really important work here, Jerry. Now, you have a lot of following on Facebook and mm-hmm. social media. How many friends do you have?
Almost 5,000.
Oh, my goodness. And if everybody listening goes out and likes you on Facebook,
yes,
missingpersonsofamerica.com, you'll have even more.
And that's important because the likes are important, but they're important because that means all these people are sharing. They're sharing out these missing person posters. And that's what it's all about. We got to get them shared out there because if you're in Missouri, you can actually go there and say, where are all the missing persons in Missouri? You can go to my website or you can go to the Facebook page. And my website, you can type in Missouri and it'll show you every single missing person that I know mm-hmm. about personally in Missouri that's missing. And then you can give that and share that out to all your friends that live in Missouri. And then it just goes from there.
Now, you just had a recent case of an Alpine man who had been missing for over 18 years.
18 years, yes.
Mike Brown, and I understand that he has now been found.
He's been found, yes. I talked to his sister who got a hold of me, and she said, I can't find him. I don't know where he is. And I said I would share all the information. And at the same time, she also told me that she wanted a little bit of advice on that. And so mm-hmm. I gave her a little bit of advice, some other things that she might be able to do. On the same token, there was a police officer here in San Diego Sheriff's Office, and she was doing a lot of research on the case. As a result, she found him.
That's fantastic.
And he was living in Louisiana.
My goodness. And I understand a family reunion is about to take place.
Yes.
That's wonderful. You've also been featured on some TV shows. I mm-hmm. understand you're becoming a bit of a national celebrity here now. Tell us about a couple of the shows you've been on and anything coming up.
Well, I do. I get calls from Discovery Channel and they want to know more information about a particular case I've written on, the verification on some facts that I have, or they want to get some advice on what to do when somebody goes missing. And I actually have a show coming up in August. I went to Arkansas to shoot the investigative discovery show, Happily Never After, and that'll be showing in August.
What advice would you give to a parent or a family member of a missing person?
Well, I have a book that I wrote that's called How to Use Social Media to Help Find a Missing Person. And it goes from detail from step one all the way to the end on all the people that you can find to help you find a missing person. And one of the first things you must do without a delay is you have to go to the police and you have to let them know that the person is missing. And the police will take in a report. And there is, I'm going to put this out there because people get this, they don't realize this, but there is no 24-hour waiting. There never has been. That's a whole Hollywood thing. If you're told to wait 24 hours, they've given you the wrong information. You need to report it, and you need to report it immediately because the first 24 hours is the most important, crucial time to look and search for a missing person.
Very good advice. Now, as media, I know we've sometimes been frustrated that we don't always receive missing person reports promptly from some of the law enforcement agencies. Is there anything a family member can or should do to urge the law enforcement to get the word out promptly on cases? Or should family members go directly to media?
They can do both. When they go to the police, they need to find out who's going to take the case. They need to find out when they're going to put it on NCIC. It's a database that only law enforcement is allowed to use, and they put the person's name in there. This is important because if the person is found, let's say they're loitering on the street and their name is not in the database, they don't know that somebody's looking for them. Wow. And they should go in there, and you can find a whole list of stuff in my book, but you can go in there and you can ask the police officer a lot of different questions to make sure that they're aware that you know your rights as far as making a report for a missing person. And they should be put in an NCIC, and they should be, you ask them, what's your next step? What are you going to do next? Where's the missing person poster? If there's delay, there's advocates out there like me and many others and nonprofit advocates out there that will do the missing person poster for you. Then you need to go to social media. It will go like fire. You put up a Facebook page and finding whoever the person's name is, or please help me find, or seeking, or whatever, and you put it up there, and you start sending it to all the advocates. All you have to do is go to Facebook, and up there in the search button, you put in missing or lost, and you'll get a list of all the advocates that's what they do, is they help other people get the word out that somebody's missing. You like all these people, you give them the poster, you give them the photograph of your missing person, and they'll get that out almost immediately, as soon as they possibly can, because they know how important the time is.
San Diego is a hub for human trafficking, and mm-hmm. a lot of people don't realize this has happened right off the streets in even very good neighborhoods. It's not just the bad part of town. It's something to be aware of, which is why that first 24 hours, as you mentioned, is so critical, especially in missing teenage cases. But there's also a lot of missing elder cases that we have, people with maybe mental health issues or dementia that are missing. And has your site been successful in reuniting some of those families?
Yes, that's one of the things that I'm particularly want to get out there as fast as possible is when a senior goes missing, because a lot of times it's dementia mm-hmm. and they don't know where they're at. And it just, I think of them sitting out there on a bus stop mm-hmm. late at night at 1 o'clock in the morning, lost or cold and not knowing where they're at, and people driving by not even knowing that they're missing.
Right. So some of them even have vehicles. We have license plates yes. that come in from the police. So the more people that know about that, these are solvable cases.
Yes. Yes, and I encourage the media to, as soon as we know somebody in San Diego, get that out there, get that information out there as fast as possible so we can get that person back home.
I should note that East County Magazine operates the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency mm-hmm. Alert Service, and we will alert on missing persons in San Diego County, countywide. So if you have a missing person, we do ask for verification. There's been a law enforcement report filed, so we can verify that it's real and not a hoax. But we will send to our list. And you can email that information to editor at eastcountymagazine.org.
That's wonderful.
Now, Jerry, how can people reach you if they have questions, if they need help, if they want more information?
Well, you go to my website, missingpersonsofamerica.com, or you can email me at jerrydean@gmail.com.
And how do you spell Jerry Dean?
jerriedean@gmail.com. jerrydean@missingpersonsofamerica.com. And then the Facebook page. You go there, I'm there. You'll see my face on there. And I talk to everybody. I answer everybody. You ask me anything. You need help with anything as far as a missing person, I can do that for you. And I'm able to get the word out. If you got a missing person, you come to me, and I'm also able to give you some advice and tell you the first thing that you need to do in order to get attention that the fact that your loved one is missing.
Very good. Well, Jerry, it's a wonderful service you're providing. I would encourage all our listeners to go on there, take a look at those missing faces, and who knows, you may just be able to help solve yes. one of these cold cases.
Right. You might just know one of these people.
Welcome to Destination East County with your host, Ariel Johansson, bringing you the most exciting festivals, events, and attractions each week. Saturday, August 3rd is the long-awaited KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso Radio Launch Party. The party, held at Mission Trails Regional Park Visitor Center, celebrates the start of a new, independent, people-powered community radio station in our region, which you are listening to right now. The station is dedicated to the news, arts, and culture of our region, including the East County Magazine radio show. Mix and mingle with radio hosts and celebrity guests in a spectacular natural setting. Enjoy live music, Native American flute players, delicious food and drinks, stargazing, museum tours, and a scavenger hunt, as well as a Golden Mike Awards presentation to leaders representing voices in our communities. Learn how you can have your voice heard on 89.1 Descanso in the heart of East County. Tickets can be purchased at www.knsj.org. The beautiful Mission Trails Regional Park Visitor Center is located at 1 Father Junipero Serra Drive in San Diego. San Pasqual's Saturday Night Live Music features the Pushpins Band. Catch local live music at the San Pasqual Winery Tasting Room in the La Mesa Village on La Mesa Boulevard on August 4th at 7 p.m. We are excited to include an upcoming event in this week's Destination East County that is a fundraiser for our own East County magazine. Enjoy our Barbecue and Wild West Fest in the countryside of beautiful Descanso on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. We will have Western reenactors from both the Hole in the Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers Gunfighters, creating for you comedy skits and roving through the crowd. Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music while guests enjoy a special tri-tip and chicken smoked barbecue dinner and browse the silent auction and drawing prizes. This event will benefit the wildfire reporting and emergency alerts that East County provides during the fire season and all year long. A featured family activity this week is Fun Believable Play's Family Fun Nights. Fun Believable Play is an indoor playground and party center in Lakeside. Their giant playground is suitable for children aged 0 to 12 years. Enjoy games, a movie, and other activities, Fridays from 5 to 8 p.m. They are located at Riverside Drive in Lakeside. The website is www.funbelievableplay.com. Wednesday night, it's ice skating at the Croc at 7:15 p.m. with special pricing. They also have a film on the field on July 31st at 7:30 p.m. Croc Center Recreation Field is located at the Salvation Army Croc Center on University Avenue, just outside of La Mesa in San Diego. Their website is www.croccenter.org. Experience Fly Days at Gillespie Field Cafe. Fly over to Gillespie Field Cafe for an afternoon of fun and watch the planes land and take off from inside the Gillespie Field Cafe. The cafe will host Fly Days every first Friday of the month. Enjoy live music, food, and more. The Gillespie Field Cafe is located at 2015 North Marshall Avenue in El Cajon. Cruise in the Lakes at Santee Lakes. This weekly car show with music and entertainment is held every Friday through October 3rd from 3 p.m. until closing. Also at Santee Lakes on Friday night, August 2nd, is Movies by the Lake with the movie Avengers, rated PG-13. On August 16th, they will be showing Rise of the Guardians. There are games and contests for kids at 7 p.m. and the movie starts at approximately 8 p.m. The location for both of these events, the car show and the movie, is Santee Lakes. Manny Cepeda performs salsa music this Friday evening, August 2nd, from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at Sunset Summer Concert Series. The concerts are held at the Macy's Courtyard in the Grossmont Center in La Mesa. There are raffle prizes every week during the band's first break, and each adult visitor receives one complimentary ticket. That's all for this week. See you around East County.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole in the Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past.
The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso is on the air, people-powered radio. Please come to our official KNSJ launch party, Saturday, August 3rd from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the beautiful Mission Trails Regional Park Visitor Center.
Come mix and mingle with our radio hosts and our celebrity guests in a spectacular natural setting. Enjoy live music, Native American flute players, delicious food and drinks, stargazing, museum tours, and a scavenger hunt. Golden Mike Awards presented to leaders and activists representing voices in our communities that are underrepresented.
RSVP and buy tickets at www.knsj.org.
This is Lynn Manyfires bringing you the Tribal Beat, covering the news for and about our region's Native American communities. Today's guest on Tribal Beat is Richard Carrico. Richard is a longtime resident of San Diego, and he's lectured for the last 25 years at the Department of American Indian Studies at San Diego State. And he's an adjunct professor at City College, where he teaches anthropology. He has a master's in history and a bachelor's in history and anthropology. His primary research includes the Kumeyaay tribes of San Diego County and Baja, Mexico. He has served as Native American coordinator and principal investigator for survey and evaluation of more than 30,000 acres of Indian trust lands, as well as serving as project director for cultural resources of five Indian tribes. Along with writing more than 30 publications and professional journals, Richard is the author of numerous books, including Strangers in a Stolen Land, The Indians of San Diego County from Prehistory to the New Deal, and he's currently working on a new book. Richard, I'm honored to have you join me today. Thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
Well, hello, Lynn. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I'd like to talk a bit about both your books, the new one as well as the most recent one, Strangers in a Stolen Land. Can you share a little bit about both books and your inspiration for writing them?
Sure. I wrote Strangers in a Stolen Land. It started actually back in the 1980s and into the 1990s because there was no one book that a student or a layperson, and I made it very much toward a layperson, could pick up and understand that Native American people had been here for 12,000 years at least, and that at one time there were 80 villages throughout San Diego County and 20,000 Native Americans living here, and then how all that changed when the Europeans came in, first the Spaniards, Mexicans, and later Americans. And I also wanted a book that had a more of an Indian voice in it. I've spent a lot of time interviewing elders and doing archaeology, and I wanted to combine that dirt side of it, that's from-the-ground archaeology, with the voice of some of the elders, Leroy Elliott and Jane Dumas, and some of those people here from the back country, frankly. So that was the impetus, and I had written several articles, and people would come to me and say, well, you've kind of teased us with a little candy here. We want the main course now. What's the rest of this? And so that's the rest of the story, as Paul Harvey used to say. And so the book goes from 12,000 years ago, which is the earliest dates we have for San Diego County, approximately up to 1938. And I intentionally stopped in 1938 after the New Deal and after the removal of the Capitan Grande Indians to Viejas and Barona, because that's my strength, that's my time period. And then after that, that's another book that might happen in the future.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
From your perspective, what changes have you seen in San Diego's tribal communities in the last 30 years?
I've seen enormous changes. When I used to lecture 30 years ago, if you were in my class 30 years ago, I would say that poverty on the average reservation in San Diego was 48% to 50% below the poverty line, that unemployment was 38% to 40%, that fetal alcohol syndrome was a major problem, and that women's groups and the Marine Corps and Salvation Army were taking turkeys and dinners up to the Indians on the reservations and that whole outreach program. And what's happened with the gaming, because of gaming, but not entirely, but because of finances, because of money, is I've seen the tribes now pull themselves up. Most of them have done a very good job. They've had very good leaders like Anthony Pico and Danny Tucker and folks who are very strong, almost traditional leaders, and they've pulled themselves up. And while using the federal government based on some things we can talk about and the county, but basically on their own. And what I've seen is now they're revitalizing their languages. And so while the Kumeyaay language was taking a serious dip by 20 years ago and very few people were speaking it except for some elders, now it's being taught at Cuyamaca College. It's being taught at Verona.
Really?
Yes. Yeah. Stan Rodriguez and Raul Chrisman from Viejas have put together classes now. And you can actually take a class in Kumeyaay, and it goes on and on and on, beginning, middle, and advanced. I've seen the ability to bring people up from Pai Pai territory and Ti Pai territory in Baja California, native people, and they work with the tribes up here and talk about language and basket making and pottery. So it's truly been a revitalization, and watching that younger generation realize that what their grandmother told them was important, and knowing a Kumeyaay word for tree or for acorn mm-hmm. is part of your culture, because language is culture, and watching little six-year-old kids speak an entire sentence in Kumeyaay. That wouldn't have happened nearly as often 20, 30 years ago. And then just the sense of pride, of tribalness, of being a nation of people, not just a band of people.
As you just mentioned, and we had spoken about it earlier, you're passionate about the revitalization of the Kumeyaay language and culture. You've just mentioned a few things of how you see that's happening. What else? How else do you see that happening in the community?
I see it happening in most of the major reservations now have also formed a group called the Circle of Elders, or somehow to honor the mm-hmm. elder. Mm-hmm. And so they have lunches for them. They take them on field trips. And again, there's that whole reaching out to both sides, the very young and the very old, not one or the other. I see it in the youth are playing a role, because they're coming to a project I've been working on. They come to the elder and say, okay, you're being tape recorded and we're hearing you talk about place names, like Tecate is actually a Kumeyaay word.
Really?
Tijuana is an Indian word. It's not Spanish. Tijuana means swept clean from the beach, swept clean.
Oh.
Tecate means it's a knife, essentially. So you're telling, granddad's recording this with you and you're hearing these, but what we want is we want to see an internet. We want to see it on video. We want to see something alive, because they're a generation that wants movement. And frankly, like most younger children, having a shorter attention span. Mm-hmm. So I'm seeing that whole movement of the very young and the older people blending together to form something that in 5 or 6 years will be huge. There's fiestas now held about native foods. Going back and using native foods, there's actually a couple cookbooks out.
Great.
One out of Heyday Press out of San Francisco or out of Berkeley, and there's recipes from San Diego County in there of using native products. Yeah.
That is awesome.
So again, it's in the kitchen, it's on the internet, it's back revitalization of language. There's a Kumeyaay mapping site that you can go to on the internet, and right now it just gives you the name of what does Powwai mean? It's not Powwai. Powwai. What does Powwai mean? Well, it means convergence, or a point where two things meet, and you click on it and you find that out. And what we're doing now is interviewing and recording elders saying these Kumeyaay words mm-hmm. so that when you click on Tecate or you click on Powwai, you'll hear a native speaker say it then, and then a picture will come up. It's out there. People think all this culture got completely lost, and unfortunately anthropologists kind of fed into that by saying 50 years ago, I'm interviewing the last of the. So anthropologists almost killed them off, in press at least. But meanwhile, the elders are sitting back there going, no, he wasn't the last one. We just didn't tell you that story because we didn't want to share it with you. Because in the Spanish period, we would be killed.
That's very
telling
common
that story.
With a lot of tribes, actually.
It is.
Yeah.
So it went underground. So I almost see it like an underground river that's now coming back up, and there's springs all over the place, and they're bubbling out, and people are drinking from those springs, and they're getting knowledge. And so to me, as a historian and an anthropologist, it's been a phenomenal process watching that. But as a person versus the academic side, it's been even more phenomenal to go on a reservation and hear people talking Kumeyaay over lunch. That would not have happened much 30 years ago.
For you, that must be a rewarding experience, huh?
It is, and it just feeds into my passion, of course. It's like, and I'm so happy to have been a part of it, not to have been instrumental in any way, because I'm not, but to just have been a part of, like, a leaf floating along on this amazing river that's going great places. It's just so cool.
And building stronger.
Yep.
Finally, with all the work you've done in our native communities with regards to sacred sites, what's your personal opinion of the wind energy projects on the various reservations?
I put wind energy into all the categories of, let's say, a large casino, a wind energy project, fracking up in the northern tier, you know, whatever thing's going on that's going to change the land. I always put it in the context of, first of all, I have to look at it from, is it serving the Native American community? So if it's on a reservation, I have to assume that the tribal council and maybe the general council voted on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so are they going to get economic revenue out of it? In some cases, are they going to get power that they wouldn't have had on the reservation before? Because there mm-hmm. are still some reservations mm-hmm. throughout the state that don't have electricity. And then you have to balance that off. That's the pragmatic side, is does it serve a practical purpose with is it actually endangering sacred sites? And then that's when it gets touchy, because they would have been required under federal law, all tribes are required on trust land to do environmental studies.
Right.
People think they don't have to do any environmental studies because it's exempt from the county. That's not true. They just have to take it to the federal level. So assuming that they did their work and assuming that they hired good anthropologists and archaeologists, I would like to believe that those wind turbines did not get sighted on a known sacred site. Having said that, for many Kumeyaay, as many Native Americans throughout America, the land itself is sacred. The viewshed is sacred. And so if you drive past Campo today or La Posta, Manzanita area, and you see those giant turbines, and now they're building some south of the border as well, a lot of them, I've certainly talked to elders who have said, yes, they did not put them on top of a sacred site, but they've impacted the sacred landscape. That as a child growing up, I could walk out of my house and see the hills and think about my grandfather's stories. When I walk out now, I see wind turbines. I hear wind turbines. I see dead birds on the ground. And so for some people, it's the wrong thing to do. But I guess I always try to come back to Native Americans are no different at some level than any other human. There's always going to be a disparity of thought between the pragmatic side, the energy side. There's always going to be, should we build a shopping center near Gettysburg or not? Does that defame Gettysburg? Do we do wind turbines on Indian land? Do we put a road across a reservation? So at what point are you bringing the tribe along versus at what point are you hurting them for generations to come by an action you want to do now?
That's a common issue, the traditionals versus the progressives on all the reservations across the country. This is definitely a complicated issue in a lot of areas. As a matter of fact, I'd like to invite you to come back next week and speak more about maybe some political views, as far as you had mentioned something about, you know, how Reagan, how Bill Clinton, how Obama is affecting the tribes, even locally here. Would you be willing to join us again?
I'd be glad to do that, because that's a whole other issue, but it has roots that go back hundreds of years with the federal government. Absolutely. I'd be glad to, Lynn.
That's awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank my guest, Richard Carrico, for sharing his rich knowledge of the tribes here in San Diego. And I'd like to invite him back to maybe talk to us again next month if in his busy schedule. And I know he is busy. Thank you, listeners, for tuning in to the Tribal Beat. If you have a story you would like to hear more about or a person of interest in the community, please contact me at tribalbeat@eastcountymagazine.org. That's tribalbeat@eastcountymagazine.org.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 Descanso, serving San Diego and East County, and streaming live worldwide on knsj.org.
This is Iris Neal. Join us for Job Talks, bringing you news about great jobs and growing our regional economy.
Job Talks on KNSJ's East County Magazine show is supported by our listeners and by the nonprofit San Diego Building Trades and Family Housing Corporation, building our future.
Johnny Simpson is here with us today. Thank you for joining us today, Johnny.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Johnny is the business manager, financial secretary of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 569, commonly referred to as the IBEW. Johnny is here today to talk to us about solar energy and other alternative energy sources. Johnny, green energy has become so important to us in the past few years. Solar energy in particular has become more widespread throughout the East County and the San Diego region. What has the IBEW done in response to the greater demand for alternative energy sources?
We've always trained for every type of electrical installation, including green energy. But over the last 10 years, we've intensified our training. We've even included some wind, geothermal, and recently we put an electrical vehicle charging station in at our training facility that's powered by our solar panels on our roof.
What do you see as the future of solar and other alternative forms of energy?
Well, as I'm sure everyone out there is aware, the price of oil and gas continues to rise, and with that increased cost that comes with that, there's just no end in sight. The industry continues to grow and move forward.
Will we see more alternative energy, and will it lower our dependence on other forms of energy?
Yes, absolutely. As the cost of oil, as I said, continues to rise, other forms of alternative energy becomes a more viable option for homeowners, businesses, everything that we do in our ordinary days.
Is there a commitment by government and private industry to install solar equipment at their facilities and businesses?
Yes, we've noticed a sharp increase as these prices continue to rise. In fact, we're hearing that there's going to be another increase here pretty quick in our region. And as those prices rise, we've seen businesses, we've seen homes, we've seen everybody trying to keep those costs down. And we're getting more and more installations every day. Our contractors, our backlogs are continuing to swell. As far as the government is concerned, pretty much every military base in the nation has now been given directives to try to find ways to put about 70% of their energy needs onto green energy. It's working out pretty well. One of our contractors here in San Diego just installed a large project out at Camp Pendleton for us.
Sounds like this is a great opportunity for folks to go into a new industry. Are there jobs available for folks, particularly folks in the East County?
Oh, absolutely. We're always looking for good electricians. We spend a lot of time, energy, and effort to get those electricians to come down and join with us. But at the same time, a lot of young people that don't have any experience, they can get started in as well through our introductory classifications, or they can join into our apprenticeship programs.
Tell me a little bit more about the apprenticeship programs that you offer.
We have apprenticeship program. It's a 5-year program. We don't just train in green energy, but we train in every aspect of the electrical industry. Electricians can't afford to specialize, but we have a lot of members that do want to specialize in the green energy, and some of our members have gone on to open their own shops specializing in some portions of our industry. However, through our apprenticeship program, it's an earn as you learn. So you work for our contractors during the day, and you go to school 2 nights a week. With that, about every 6 months, you get a pay rate increase. You get college credit for the apprenticeship. So I think you're a couple semesters away of general ed from your AA degree once you graduate our program. And we pay for all of that. The only thing you have to buy is your books. We sell books at cost. We're not in the business to make money on schools. We're in the business to train good electricians for our futures.
So it sounds like the paid apprenticeship trainings are available to anybody. How much does it cost them to receive this training, and how does one apply?
It doesn't cost them anything. It's all free. You just make application. You need to get in our apprenticeship program, you need to be a high school graduate with at least 1 year of algebra with a C or better. Then you'll take a test. Everyone that passes the test gets an interview. And through the interview process, we select those that we feel can come into our industry and have a reasonable chance of success through our apprenticeship program. It's not an easy program. It's not meant to be easy. We're looking for the best and the brightest out there to be electricians.
Is there a high demand for workers in this industry? And what type of positions can they secure once they complete the apprenticeship training?
We have electricians that have been with us, you know, their whole careers. I personally am a 35-year electrician. We have electricians that have never been without work in their whole career. We have electricians that take a little time off, go to the beach in the summers, that sort of thing. So one thing about our nation and our world is there's always a demand for electricity and people that know how to use it and what to do with it and how to install it. So our industry continues to move forward and our unions continue to grow.
What about home solar energy? Do your contractors do that work as well?
Yeah, in fact, the most recent article I read here in San Diego, we have 3 top contractors here in San Diego doing residential solar installations. They're all IBEW contractors and utilizing our members to do those installs for them.
Currently, I understand there's a lot of work available in Imperial County. How long do you feel that will continue?
Well, I'm currently sitting on about 3,500 megawatts of signed contracts in Imperial Valley. A lot of those jobs, they're on different projects, and a lot of those jobs may or may not start. The vast majority probably will. We're working on 4 projects right now that equal about 500 megawatts of energy. And in those projects, we're a little over 1,100 guys working on those projects right now. Around San Diego and Imperial County, I think I've got about 1,300 to 1,400 members right now working on green energy jobs.
Have you seen an influx of East County residents commuting to Imperial County to work in this field?
Yeah, Imperial County, pretty much we drive everywhere. We drive our local 569's jurisdiction goes from the Mexican border all the way to San Clemente and from the water to Arizona. So our members are used to driving a little bit. So the East County residents, it's a little easier for them to get down to Imperial Valley than it is to get to, say, Camp Pendleton. So a lot of our East County members are working in Imperial Valley right now. It's hot down there, but they're doing a good job, and they get paid a little extra to work in that heat.
Johnny, what is the pay rate while they're training?
It depends on what classification you are as far as your pay rate is concerned. We have a lot of young folks coming in with no experience, and they're not in the apprenticeship and all of that. We call it a starter rate. And they can earn about $18.50 with benefits and all of that. It's about $12 on your check, and the rest you get health care and a small pension. For a first-year apprentice just starting out, it's about $15 an hour plus benefits, so it's, I think, about $22, somewhere in that neighborhood. But you get, like I say, every 6 months you're entitled to a raise, assuming that you got your hours in and completed your class. And you'll get a raise every 6 months. For an apprentice, again, it's a 5-year program, but when you turn out of the apprenticeship as what we call a JW, a journeyman wireman, guys in Imperial right now, as I said, get a little bit extra, so their total package right now is about $54.50, somewhere in that neighborhood. But that includes their health and welfare and their pension.
Wow, that's great. How about after they graduate from the apprenticeship program, they're actually on the field? What is the going rate for positions in this field?
Well, we have a lot of positions available. Our journeymen wiremen are our most coveted group, and obviously they're our most expensive group. But at the same time, these guys stay working. Our industry is one that, again, you can't specialize. You can't be just working on one thing. You have to be able to wire a house or work on a nuclear power plant or a solar plant or anything else. That's how we make a living in our industry. And our folks have to be able to do all of those things. And we get that through continued training. Our apprenticeship building is not just for apprentices and other classifications. Our journeymen are required to continue their training as well. In fact, here in California, in order to work as a journeyman wireman in the commercial field or the residential field, you have to pass a test called a state certification test. And that makes you legal to work in the state of California.
It sounds like they can take this training and work in other states as well. Is there a lot of folks that are doing that? This is so transferable skills.
Yeah, throughout the IBEW, we're nationwide in Canada. We have our members working around the nation right now. We have members from other areas coming into our area to work as well. We call it traveling. It just depends on what a guy wants to do. When I turned out of the apprenticeship, again, 35 years ago, I traveled around and spent about 3 years on the road working in different areas. A lot of young guys like to do that. You can follow the big jobs, make a lot of money, get a lot of overtime, all of that good stuff. But, you know, once you get a little bit older, you sort of like to stay a little closer to home. So you hope that there's plenty of work in your area to keep you busy.
Great. And is there a lot of opportunity for folks that are like midlife trying to change careers, second careers?
Sure. We don't have any age discrimination or any of that sort of thing. All of our folks, our apprenticeship class works out pretty well. We have some young folks in there, fresh out of high school, first job. And we have some folks that have been in the industry for a while, maybe working as an electrician, maybe working in other fields, and decided they wanted to make career changes. And we find that really works out well for us in that some of the younger guys see the older guys, and they understand what the older guys seem to think, know what they're getting into, and be able to help the younger guys along. Maybe they've been out of school for a while, the older guys I'm speaking of. So the younger guys help the older guys get back into good study habits and those things so they can pass our schools.
And how does one go about finding out about joining the union?
There's actually three places you can apply. You can come to our union hall here in San Diego. It's at 4545 View Ridge Avenue here in San Diego, 92123. Or you can go to our Imperial Valley offices. That's located at 2420 Imperial Business Park Drive in Imperial, California, 92251. Or you can, if you want to apply for our apprenticeship program, you can go to our training facility, and that's located at 4675 View Ridge Avenue, and the zip is 92123. Or you can just go to positivelyelectric.org, and that'll take you right to our training facility, and you can make application.
Does the training program start at certain times during the year? Is there a time that they have to apply by a deadline? Or are they ongoing programs that they can apply for at any time?
Yeah, we give the test twice a year. So if you're interested in the apprenticeship program, you need to go ahead and get signed up as soon as possible. We give the test twice a year and generally interview twice a year for positions. We start a class every semester. We run on a tri-semester, meaning that it's not like high school where you just go two semesters. We also have summer class as well. So we have a tri-semester going, and we influx our people based on how they did on their test and interview.
And does this work well with someone that is working in another field right now, saying working a regular 40-hour job but wants to transition into an apprenticeship with your program?
Yeah, it works out real well. We have a lot of folks that have come from other industries that maybe they were construction workers, maybe they were working retail, maybe they were doing other things and decided they wanted to become an electrician, and they came down and took our test and did well on the interview, and now they're working as apprentices in our program or have already turned out and they're journeyman wiremen.
Do you find that there's an influx of women entering this industry?
We've never had those types of issues. In fact, there were two women in my apprenticeship class. One of them lives in East County here. She became, to my knowledge, the first woman president of an IBEW construction local in the nation. So she did very well. She was a foreman at one of our major contractors here in town for a lot of years before she retired. In fact, we're always looking for women that you're getting out there, you're getting dirty, you're getting cut up, you're doing all of those things. But if you like working outside and you like using your hands and you're mechanically inclined, come on down. We can use you.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Johnny Simpson from the Business Manager, Financial Secretary of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. That's Local 569, commonly referred to as IBEW. Thanks for being with us today, Johnny.
Oh, thank you.
This is Helen Ofield from the Lemon Grove Historical Society, bringing you the sounds of history. My guest today is Jack Doherty, who was a member of Lemon Grove's very first city council back in 1977, and he is a lifelong history buff. Jack, welcome.
Oh, I'm happy to be here, Ellen.
You and your wife, Marion, have a long-standing involvement with education in East County, especially the community college district and the growth thereof. Right now, your research centers on the Hamashaw Schoolhouse and School District. It sounds like a great story. Can you tell us something about that?
I'll be happy to. The Hamashaw Valley is the area of San Diego County that's roughly bounded by Grossmont Cuyamaca College, I should say, on the north, and the Steel Canyon Golf Course on the east. It began as a farming community, and long about 1877, they decided they needed to have a place to educate the kids, and starting in an old barn that would be located now roughly along Willow Glen Road, a small number of homestead families set up a school in a barn. That proved unsatisfactory, and in 1884, one of the local farmers donated a plot of land, and they built a schoolhouse on that land. Adjacent to the schoolhouse was a small store, a post office, then called the Davidson Post Office, and a blacksmith shop. Those two pieces of property became the hub of what they called Hamashaw Village. That area was kind of the thriving center of a small farming community at the turn of the century.
My goodness. So from the barn to a community, this is a kind of Horatio Alger, up from the hay bale into the modern world kind of story. The other uses then of that schoolhouse were what? It sounds like it was a community hub.
What happened, the heyday of that area really began in the land boom of 1885. That land boom, which of course was a part of the development of the city of San Diego, created a need for vegetables, other farming goods that came out of the nearby Hamashaw Valley. After the turn of the century and the rise of the modern automobile, what you found was that you got better roads. You began to get more motor vehicles coming out on Sunday drives, going out along what they called Campo Road then, and now is Highway 94. And by 1915, the County of San Diego had set up a road station at the entrance to the Hamashaw Valley, which led eventually to the paving of Highway 94. because the center of this small Hamishaw community was about 2 miles away from Highway 94, the commercial center of the community and the commercial activity gravitated over to where the paved road was. The Hamishaw Village area was no longer the center of activity, and by 1920, the school had shut down. And in part, that was due to both the small size of the community and the availability of transportation of students who at that time would be bused or motored into El Cajon, which had formed a school district in 1920.
When Highway 94 came along, are we talking 1956, somewhere in there, when that freeway definitively arrived as the main artery into East County? I think it was the mid-1950s.
What we call Highway 94 has long been an artery. It was a stagecoach route, which went through the Jamul area, subsequently went out towards Tecate, and then through Campo. That was the route if you were going to go across the desert or, you know, towards Yuma, Arizona.
Yes.
And, of course, long before Interstate 8. So following the stagecoach route, it was natural for first county dirt roads to be maintained, a bridge to be built across the Sweetwater River. Then, as paving advanced, that road was simply paved and continued to be a significant travel route as it is today.
So cars literally drove, to make a very bad pun, the growth of so much in East County. That is a very interesting story, Jack. What else are you focused on education-wise in East County?
Well, if I can drop back for just a second, the closure of the school district in the Hamishaw Village didn't end the story of the schoolhouse. In 1920, the local residents, still wanting a community focus, created the Hamishaw Community Club. About 3 years after that, they were able to purchase the old schoolhouse, and the schoolhouse became the place, you know, literally for the next 30-some years, a meeting place, a community center, a place for...
So it lives on as we speak.
It does. It's now a private residence. It was converted to a private residence in the early 1960s and has, you know, been developed, as has what had been the store next door. It's also now a private residence.
So it has lived on into the 21st century. That's remarkable. Jack, you're so good to come by and share this with us. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure.
And thank you, listeners, for listening to The Sounds of History. I'm Helen Ofield.
This is Janice Moore, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world. Today I'm talking with James Pearson from Ember Arts, founded in Jamul here in East County, now with offices in Ocean Beach and El Cajon. His company sells handmade jewelry that's beautiful and every color of the rainbow. They're called Aicholi beads, and there's a fascinating story behind them. How did you first discover these beads?
Yeah, good question. So I actually moved to Uganda in 2006 to work with a nonprofit. And through some friends, I met these women who were living in a slum just outside the capital. And they were working in a rock quarry, which in Uganda means sitting on the ground and pounding rocks with kind of a makeshift hammer for hours and hours every day. And they were just barely making enough to survive, about $1 a day. But on the side, they were making this beautiful jewelry. I saw that jewelry, and the only thing they were missing was a good market to sell it in. And so that was kind of how we first got involved with them.
Oh, wow. I can't imagine what those women must have been going through as they were working so long. How difficult was life for their families?
Oh, it was real difficult. So all the women that we're working with, they had to flee their homes in the north of Uganda because there was a 20-year-long civil war. And they had been moved into these really terrible displaced persons camps, and then they fled those two and ended up the only place they could find to live was this slum outside the capital. And the work that they're doing is just tremendously difficult. And to only make $1 a day, I mean, they've got kids to feed, they've got to provide shelter. It's a really tough life.
Oh no, that sounds terrible. So you noticed the unusual jewelry that they wore. These look like ceramic beads, each in multiple colors. So how are they made?
Yeah, good question. In fact, they're not ceramic at all. They're, believe it or not, they're all made from recycled paper. So in Uganda, there's this marketplace where you can just buy kind of discarded paper from around the country. They go in there, they find these beautiful colors, and they'll cut a long strip and they'll hand roll every bead and then string it together into beautiful jewelry.
Wow, that sounds like a cool process. Then you offered to try and help them by bringing some jewelry back to the United States to sell these items. How did that work out, and where are they sold?
There were four women that we started working with, and I would go and kind of hand choose every piece of jewelry and give it to a friend who was coming back to America and say, hey, take this to my family. We just sold at, you know, farmers markets and crafts markets and things like this. And then we started approaching stores, at first kind of smaller gift shops and boutiques, but the last couple of years we've been working with some larger chains like Whole Foods.
Wow, that's great that it's been so successful. Now, this is a fair trade company that you've started. Can you tell us what that means?
Yeah, fair trade is, it's just a way of thinking about business that says that everybody along the line, from the people who are initially producing something to even the consumer at the end, should be able to benefit and feel good about what they're doing. So we've worked really hard with the women in Uganda that we work with to say, what's a fair price for what you're selling us? And what else can we do to, you know, benefit your lives?
Now, where can people learn more about helping these women in Uganda? And where can they find Acholi beads?
So our website, emberarts.com, it's emberarts.com, is a great place to learn more about it. We also have an online store there that people can purchase from. And we've got a map that shows all of the retailers that you can find our jewelry in.
Thank you for sharing your story with East County Magazine on KNSJ 89.1, the Network for Social Justice. You can also read our story and see photos of Acholi beads at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
Howdy! East County Magazine and KNSJ invite you to our Barbecue and Wild West Fest on Saturday, August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. at the historic Descanso Town Hall in Descanso. Round up your friends and family for this fun-filled event. We'll have a Wild West show featuring the Hole-in-the-Wall Gang and the Gaskell Brothers reenacting scenes from our region's colorful Western past.
The Pine Creek Posse Band will provide live music, so grab your partner and bring your dancing shoes, or should we say cowboy boots. Plus, the Descanso Junction will be cooking up a tri-tip barbecue feast. We'll also have prizes and surprises at our Wild West Fest, which is all a benefit to support our wildfire reporting, alerts, and nonprofit community news. Yee-haw! Reservations are going fast, so save your spot now for our August 10th Wild West Fest. Call 619-698-7617 or email editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Today, you can also find more details at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
California prisoners are starving for change. A hunger strike that began earlier this month is nearing the end of its third week, with fewer than 1,000 inmates at 11 prisons still refusing meals. At issue is the widespread use of segregated housing units for prisoners in long-term solitary confinement. Laura Magnani with American Friends Service Committee says 15 days is considered the maximum time in the tiny windowless cells, yet the average stay is 6 years.
It's important that people recognize that this is a very courageous, highly venerated, nonviolent practice that they've adopted. Instead, the prison tends to treat it like a disturbance and to punish the people who are on hunger strike.
Prison officials have called the hunger strike a mass disturbance that's being organized by prison gangs. Magnani says the conditions qualify as torture.
They could be allowed time with other people. They could be allowed visits with family on a regular basis, phone calls with family on a regular basis, and access to programs. Those kinds of things would go a long way.
Inmate advocates met with prison officials earlier this week, but Magnani says officials didn't show any willingness to budge. For Public News Service, I'm Lori Abbott.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's live radio show. We extend our appreciation to the San Diego Performance Academy for the use of their studio, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County and Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, Brian Boykel, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.